SF Signal Episode 71, Interview with William Gibson. This is the SF Signal Podcast, as powered by the Functional Nerds. My name is Patrick Hester. I'm an author, a blogger, and an all-around functional nerd. And this is episode 71, which is an interview with William Gibson. William Gibson is an award-winning author. His novel Neuromancer won the Nebula, Hugo, and Philip K. Dick Awards, respectively. His books and short stories span many different genres, including but not limited to cyberpunk and steampunk. He's credited with coining the term cyberspace. His latest novel, Zero History, is set in a contemporary world not too far removed from our own, and is available on August 2nd from Berkeley Trade Paperbacks. So here is my interview with William Gibson. And tonight on the line, I have with me prolific author William Gibson. Hi, William.
Hi.
How are you?
I'm pretty good on a hot day in Vancouver.
I didn't think Vancouver had hot days.
It's been a long time coming. This is one of the first we've had this year.
Now, obviously, you are the gentleman who coined the phrase, is it cyberspace?
Yes.
Yes. Your debut novel was Neuromancer.
Yeah.
So that was 84.
Yes.
Since then, you've gone on to write a lot of books that have really shaped science fiction over the course of two decades, almost three now. You say 84, 94, 2004. Yeah, we're almost going into the third.
Yeah, well, as science fiction writers go, I actually haven't been that prolific. I've written 9 novels and one in collaboration with Bruce Sterling, and a slender volume of short stories, so that's not a huge output.
But you know what? Sometimes it's quality, not quantity.
Well, thank you.
you've written cyberpunk as well, and steampunk.
Well, we wrote. You know, I was writing cyberpunk, I guess, before anybody thought to call it that. And I in a funny way, the difference engine is steampunk before I had ever heard the word steampunk. Steampunk's been a strange thing for me. It's like it jumped. It jumped from a little bit of fiction over about 20 years directly onto Etsy and into people's jewelry drawers and stuff.
Yes, it did.
It's like you skip the part where you have to do the movies and you just go straight to the cosplay. That's kind of a new way for it to happen.
Now, when you do write books, it looks to me like you do trilogies. Now, do you intentionally do trilogies, or does that just sort of happen for you?
Well, as you know, ridiculous as it sounds, since I've done it 3 times now, it actually does just sort of happen. When I start, I consciously start with the out that if somehow I'm just not that into whatever this book is going to become when I finish it, the next one could be something completely different. And I've done that every time with Neuromancer and Virtual Light and Pattern Recognition. I said, you know, it could be, I don't know what this is, maybe it's a one-off. Maybe this time it's a one-off, and the next one can be something different. But so far it hasn't so far it hasn't happened. And by the time I've done a second book in that particular universe, I'm pretty much committed to doing a third. But when I've got two, I can triangulate. You know, at the beginning of a first book, to think that it's part of some sort of three volume unit is pretty overwhelming. It's better. I can do it if I just sit down and say, okay, I'm gonna write a book. And I always do sort of wait for something to have changed that will cause me to start writing one-off novels, which I'm not at all opposed to. It's just never happened to me. In a way, I think that's novels are best that way, but I've never really managed to do it, except for the Difference Engine with Sterling, which is sort of absolutely a one-off thing.
Understood. Now, how do you find your inspiration for some of these books? You know, the way technology is changing. You know, now the NASA space program has changed completely. I mean, just the way things. How do you stay ahead of that and continue writing? You know, fiction that I want to say is on the cutting edge.
Well, I've always assumed that what I was really doing was always about whatever moment I was doing it in. It can't literally be about the future because nobody knows what the future is going to be. But I've also assumed that futureness arrives unevenly. And so, you know, one part of town gets a little bit of the future, and the people across the river don't get so much future. So I've developed some sort of instinct for looking for those futury bits. And when I see something that looks to me, that feels that way to me, I sort of pick it up and toss it in a hopper, and the hopper gradually fills up with this stuff, and it sort of ferments or something. And when I start writing, I start pulling these things out, these kind of mutated bits of the present out of the hopper and fitting them together. And if they fit in a certain way, they sort of take off. And then I wind up with something that feels sort of like a future. And then the job in large part is just to make that thing bigger and self-consistent within itself. And if it works, it acquires a momentum of its own, which sustains me through the narrative. But the last three books have been actually set a year before they were published. So my three most recent books are speculative novels of the very recent past, and somehow the experience of doing that was more like what I had always thought science fiction was supposed to be like than the more traditional approach I had taken earlier.
And let's talk about those three books for a second. So these are being called the Bijan, I think is how it's pronounced, Bijan trilogy.
Well, yeah, it depends on one's skill with French, and
since
I have none at all, so I call them the big end books.
There you go. And these there's three, so it's Pattern Recognition, Spook Country, and Zero History.
Yes.
And tell us a little bit about these books.
Well, pattern recognition is set, I think, about 6 months after 9/11. And Spook Country is set somewhere, I've sort of lost track of the years, some maybe a year into the U.S. occupation of Iraq, or I don't know, sort of like the beginning of the second Bush administration. Okay. And Zero History is winter before last. So so 9, let's see, 2001. So 2002 to 2008, 2009.
Okay.
Something like that. And they're in a sense, they're designed to date, or they're designed to be very dateable. And that's deliberately the opposite of my MO when I write fiction set in imaginary futures.
Sure.
Because it's the I always thought part of the art of that is not letting the reader figure out exactly when the imaginary future is. Gives it a kind of more shelf life that way. But with these past three, I wanted the reader to know, okay, this is this very particular time, because I don't think the real past doesn't date. It just gets further in the past.
And in the first book, Pattern Recognition, who are the characters and what's kind of setting up that world?
Well, the protagonist of Pattern Recognition is a woman named Case Pollard, who's come from very traumatized post 9/11 New York to London to do a job of work for a sort of PR advertising agency called Blue Ant, who are very, very cutting edge and very of the moment, and they're run by this crazy and slightly sinister Belgian character named Hubertus Bigend. And Case has some strange power. She's sort of like a comic book superhero, but in a different way, in that you can show her a logo for some new product or a new logo for your company, and she can just tell you whether or not it's gonna fly. It's a completely unconscious thing.
That would be a very handy thing to have too.
Yeah, well, it would certainly be marketable. You know, if you had proven your ability, but in the way that superpowers always have some, you know, terrible cost, like. For her, the terrible cost is that she's phobic, generally, of logos. So she has to remove all the branding from everything she owns, or it'll make her break out break out in a rash. And if she's exposed to certain logos or certain brands, she can actually go into anaphylactic shock. So she has to be very, she's kind of a girl in a branding bubble. And in some wacky way, I got that not from Naomi Klein's book, No Logo, but simply from the title of Naomi Klein's book, No Logo, which I suppose I saw walking past the bookstore. Somehow it went into the hopper with this other stuff. And I got Case's branding allergy. And really, she's the, you know, there are quite a few other characters, but she's the protagonist of, very much of that one.
And she goes on a little bit of an adventure because she gets hired by Big End.
Well, Big End wants her to find the artist behind a mysterious series of web videos, who's the aficionados of this series call it the footage. And they're just little, very intense, kind of Bergman-esque clips. Kind of possibly, I forget. They may even be black and white. It's been a while since I looked at the thing. And Case is a fan of these things, and she hangs out on an internet board, and talks to other people who are into this stuff, and they're all trying to figure out what it is. And Big End gives her this very highly paid assignment to find who's doing this stuff. And in a way, one of the ways that dated immediately, and it was a way that I had no way of anticipating when I wrote it, was that the book fortunately managed to be published just before YouTube launched. So the book is set in a pre-YouTube universe, and it only makes sense in a pre-YouTube universe. The plot only makes sense because in the plot, the maker of the footage hides the footage all in these kind of odd places all over the World Wide Web. And as soon as YouTube launched, that, you know, became a very archaic way to do it. Because in the YouTube world, the footage would either appear on YouTube or it would instantly migrate to YouTube. So Case and all her footage heads friends would be watching a footage YouTube channel talking about this stuff.
Well, okay, I can see that. But, you know, there's also there's a viral thing that some people do sometimes, which is they build a website that has clues to something, and that leads you to another website, and then another website, and then another one. And yeah, sometimes, like, are you familiar with Lost, the TV show Lost?
Yeah.
One of the things that they did at one point was they had the videos of the what was it called? You know, the little experiment that was going on the island. Yeah. So they had these training videos, and they had clips from the training videos spread all over the web.
Yeah, I think I actually. I've heard about that one, but before I began Pattern Recognition, I was aware of a couple of earlier attempts to do that.
Gotcha. And, well, I mean, it sounds fascinating. It really does. I mean, even though you sort of wrote it to be dated, I think it's still a compelling story.
Well, I'm okay with it. I'm okay with it being very much of its day, because what I was trying to get a handle on was the zeitgeist of that moment, like, you know, exactly how that period was making me feel, which is something there's, you know, not really any way to express ordinarily, but it's through the structure of writing that book, I found a way to sort of get a core sample of the zeitgeist and make it the core of the piece. And so I think the good thing about doing it that way is that you wind up with this really weird artifact. So someone reading it today, it may be an even stranger experience than someone reading it when it was published, because it was published shortly after the time that the book is saying it felt like this.
Sure.
So when you're closer to it, it's more familiar. But people, I don't know. I know it still works for people. I'm happy with it that way.
And it's interesting that for the second novel, Spook Country, you did not carry Case over. You kept Big End,
yeah.
And you came up with a new protagonist.
Yeah, I came up with a Cuban Chinese sort of folk ninja named Tito, whose family has come surreptitiously to live in New York, and are the smallest big time organized crime family in the United States as of having arrived. But since they're sort of all ex-KGB people from Havana, so they've sort of their culture is like half KGB spycraft and half Santeria, and I like Tito, and I liked his family, because they're almost like characters out of a fantasy novel. Like Tito believes that he's possessed by the gods of the pantheon of his particular religion, and so he has those experiences, and you're viewing the world through him. So you're in this inherently fantastic world. It doesn't necessarily follow in terms of what the narrative tells you that that's real, but that's the way Tito experiences it. And that's like very powerful central entities in his life that he's dealing with. But other than a few of his relatives, nobody else in the book is plugged into that aspect of the world.
And it's interesting that in the first book and the second book, both protagonists kind of have, they're looking for answers about their fathers.
Yeah, that's true. But you know, many people are, I think. there's a kind of, you know, kind of Joseph Campbell thing in that.
And so that carries us into the third book, which is Zero History. and another. Now you carried over Big End and Hollis into this one.
Yeah, Hollis Henry is the other protagonist from Spook Country. He's a kind of retired indie rock singer who's trying to be has run out of money and is trying to be a journalist. And Big End actually hires her because someone he wants to get next to is an obsessive fan of hers. she doesn't know that. She thinks she's being hired as a reporter. But Big End is actually hiring the one woman that this crazy obsessive hacker guy might be willing to come out of his cave to say hello to.
And so, you know, what is a little bit of her journey in this one?
Well, she's learning just how dangerous it is to get involved, how dangerous and weird it is to get involved with Big End, and it's gotten even more dangerous and weird than it was before for Case, because Big End has become an even bigger deal. And Big End is an incredibly handy character for me because he's curious about everything and he's got enormous resources to throw at any whim of curiosity that crosses his mind. And he loves secrets. He loves finding out secret things. So there's really no. He's like the Swiss Army knife of narrative engines. Anything you want to do in the book, you just have to have Big End sort of look out the window and say, "Ah, I really want to find out about this," and because I just do. And the way he's set up, the reader goes, "Well, he does. Cool. Now we'll find out about that.
Now this book is coming out from Berkeley. Berkeley trade paperback is what I have here.
Yes, which is in this century one of the imprints of Penguin USA.
Okay.
But I love Berkeley because Berkeley was my very first publisher. They published Neuromancer. So I have an almost unbroken history with them, like back to the very beginning.
So it kind of like coming back home.
Yeah.
Very nice. And this is being released on August 2nd?
Oh, yeah, it is. I wonder if it's kind of when we find out whether or not the United States will be able to pay its bills.
Oh, wow. Boy.
Okay.
Yes. And, you know, this is going to be out there as a trade paperback. Are you going to be doing any book signings or any appearances anywhere in support of the book?
I am. But I'm such a promotion slob. I think I'm in. I can't. You know, I don't have it right in front of me. I'm in Seattle. I think at the University Bookstore. I think on the evening of the 2nd, and on the 3rd, I think it's Madison, Wisconsin. And maybe on the 4th, Boston, and then New York on the 6th. But if you Google William Gibson zero history, you might be able, you know, you might be able to turn up some sort of handy schedule of these things. I should go immediately and blog one.
You should, yes.
Yes.
And that reminds me, why don't you tell folks where they can find you on the web? What's your website?
Oh, dear.
It's here. Here's a hint. It's WilliamGibsonBooks.com.
Ah, okay. Okay, it is WilliamGibsonBooks.com.
Yes.
Which you can Google. But you can much more easily and reliably find me on Twitter as Great Dismal, which is one word, GREATDISMAL.
And so, yes.
And I'm much more a Twitter creature these days.
And I believe I'm following you. I am. Yep. I just logged in and I'm following you. ATFMB.
Okay.
And I love your little picture here. What is this picture of?
That is a piece of graffiti that I photographed actually by accident in Oaxaca, Mexico, last fall.
Okay, so you have to tell me, how do you photograph a piece of graffiti by accident?
I shot a really beautiful, totally wrecked 18th century doorway from across the street. And I took a lot of, took a lot of trouble with framing it up and getting the doorway in and getting the whole thing and getting the steps. And so I got the doorway, and, you know, months later, like 6 months later, I was like flipping through these shots. And I realized that on each side of the door, on this sort of stone panel, on this ancient, huge door. This door was like 20 feet tall. And so sort of in the door, stone door frame of this ancient wooden door, somebody had painted that little guy.
Oh, gosh.
Spray painted that little guy on each side of the door. And I hadn't even noticed it because I was focused on the door, so I'm sort of like blowing it up and checking it out. And Oaxaca's like very graffiti rich environment. They had a bunch of civic unrest down there a few years ago, and there's a big art school there, and out of that came this very Banksy style kind of high-tech graffiti tradition, which you still see around town. But that little guy that I'm currently using on Twitter was very kind of loose and took somebody like eight seconds to do.
Yes. That's funny. Well, I want to thank you for coming on with us tonight. I promise you we'd keep you about 25, 30 minutes, and we're coming up on that right now.
Okay. Well, it's been a pleasure.
Well, anytime you have anything you want to, tell our listeners about, just give me a call.
Okay. Well, thank you, Patrick. It really has been nice.
Good. Great. Thank you.
Okay. Bye-bye.
There you have it, our interview with Mr. William Gibson. Thanks again for coming on, sir. We do appreciate it. You should be checking out sfsignal.com each and every day. You should be following John D on Twitter, twitter.com/sfsignal. If you're looking for me, I am ATFMB. That's ATFMB.com, twitter.com/ATFMB, all that good stuff. Check back next week for another great interview and another great panel. I think that's pretty much it for me for today. It's Sunday. It's hot. It's the usual stuff. I will talk to you guys next week. Bye.